June 10th, 2011. It's the Lullabot Podcast. Hi, it's Jeff Robbins back with Lullabot Podcast number 94. This week, Jared Ponchot and I have an interview with Josh Clark, who is the author of the book Tapworthy, and is basically omnipresent at all mobile conferences. He's Mr. Mobile, and he's going to be speaking at the Do It With Drupal conference that Lullabot is running in October in Brooklyn, New York. And he's going to be keynoting, actually, and we thought it'd be great to get him on the podcast and talk to him a little bit about mobile stuff and get the Drupal people excited about all this stuff that Josh is excited about and thinking about mobile. It's the future, man. Mobile is the future. We've got some workshops coming up. If you're listening to this podcast basically on the day that it comes out, then next week, June 13th through the 17th, we've got a module deep dive workshop in Providence, Rhode Island. There's still a few seats left for that one. Get in quick. There are also some seats left for the Zero to Hero workshops happening in New York City, June 27th through July 1st. That's a different set of workshops. It's going to be learning to build and theme a Drupal 7 site in a week. 1 week. It's actually two workshops, building a Drupal 7 site and theming, but you can take the whole thing beginning to end and learn everything you need to become a hero. So the title would say, the workshops in Providence, module building, workshops in New York City, building and theming a Drupal site. I mentioned earlier the Do It With Drupal conference. We've got a super early bird discount, which is ending on July 1st. So if you're interested in attending Do It With Drupal in New York City, in Brooklyn, actually, in October, register before July 1st and get it cheap. doitwithdrupal.com is where you can find out more information about the Do It With Drupal conference. And for all of our workshops and other upcoming events, you can go to lullabot.com/events. All right, well, let's get started with our interview with Josh Clark. Josh Clark, welcome to the Lullabot Podcast.
Man, I am so happy to be here. Thanks.
It's great to have you. We've got Jared Ponchot on as well. Hi, Jared.
Hi, Jared.
Hi there. Good to be here.
Jared's going to be providing the designer, information architect perspective. I will be providing the perspective of the rube. So Josh, you live in Providence.
I do. Sunny Providence, Rhode Island.
World traveler, but you know, every so often you stop by here in Providence. So
come home to Little Rhodey.
Yes. And for people that don't know, I live just outside of Providence as well. So
we let him in the city limits, though.
Yeah,
we're welcome him.
Yes, I have a card so I can get in across the border. So we wanted to have you on the podcast. First of all, we've got you coming and speaking at the Do It With Drupal conference in Brooklyn in October, and we're really excited about that. You're going to be keynoting and telling us Yay! All about mobile stuff. How was that? Was that rubish?
That sounded rubish. Yeah, no, that was good. I think, to be honest, you know, this is also new that we're all a little bit rubes and noobs in this thing, you know? So it's, I think mobile stuff is about where we're all at.
Well, let's just call it mobile stuff then.
That's it. That's
Eventually, it. That's we'll it. Have some sort of more enterprise term that people will refer to when texting each other on their Blackberries. But Yeah, mobile stuff, which is kind of the theme of this year's Drupal conference. We wanted to provide sort of a central thread throughout the conference this year. There's really interesting stuff happening in mobile. And one of the philosophies of Do It With Drupal is that there's more to Drupal than Drupal. To build a successful Drupal site, you need to know more than just understanding Drupal. You need to have a larger context to your knowledge, and whether that's understanding project scoping, project management, or even like database optimization and stuff like that. If you want to build a successful Drupal site, you need to understand more. Mobile is getting to be something that you really need to understand. And I think for a lot of us who've been spending our time with our noses down in the PHP, mobile has been sort of, it's kind of scratching at the door. Yeah, whatever. But it's kind of time for us to figure it out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, as consumers, we know that, right? I mean, the thing is, you know, most of us, especially those of us who are in this industry and in the tech business, you know, are carrying around these phones, and we're using mobile as consumers, and we routinely have crummy mobile experiences. We're like, oh, why won't they get on board? And yet we're not yet thinking about that as technologists as much, right? We're not embracing that in our own work as quickly as we're embracing it as consumers.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I certainly use a lot of mobile apps, but I don't know where they come from.
Yeah, right. They come from, you know, this magic rainbow in the sky.
And maybe there's also
a
this
double rainbow in the sky.
Maybe there's also this concept of like with desktop apps, right? I'm a web developer. It all seems like stuff I can understand. CSS, I make my images, I do some design work, HTML, very simple. JavaScript, a little more complicated. PHP, okay, now we're getting, but it's all kind of, but to sit down and write like a C++ app or, something, I don't even know where I would start to create a Mac or a Windows app. And now we're asking all these web developers to start creating mobile apps, but yet there's sort of these hybrid kind of places they can start the mobile web. And then we start to get into things like, PhoneGap and, sort of HTML5 based, apps, actual proper compiled apps. And it starts to get to be a little bit more accessible. And I guess one of the goals of all of this, and this podcast for that matter, is to start getting people thinking about mobile and maybe start to discuss some concepts that seem, okay, I can understand that in the same way that I can understand HTML. I can understand creating images and CSS and start to make this accessible because it is. And not only that, but it's scratching at the door. We just need to figure it out.
Yeah, well, I mean, just talking about this spectrum of options that you mentioned, you've got, you know, mobile websites on one side, you've got these native apps written in, you know, different languages for Android versus Windows Phone versus iPhone. You know, so it means you need like an honest to God hardcore experienced programmer within sophisticated programming languages to write each one of those platforms. So that's a very sort of complex task with often sort of high-end results. You know, you can kind of do more with native apps than you can on the mobile web. But then in the middle, as you mentioned, there's this sort of hybrid approach where you can actually write a web app and put all of your stuff and bundle it into a native app that then you can sort of essentially sell your web app in the app stores. So there's a sort of spectrum of approaches. But I think that one thing that's really important, and they all have strengths and weaknesses, but I think that one thing that's important to realize is that this is sort of the front end code, you know, that whether it's a mobile website or a native app or something in between, you know, this is the sort of a thin client that talks to the back end, that talks to Drupal. And that the challenge for us now as people who manage the content management system, as design the data structure, is to make sure that no matter what that front end is, that you have this sort of flexible data store on the back end that can manage to sort of be future-proof, you know, to be able to talk to whatever type of front-end client is out there. Because, you know, it's intimidating right now, right? We've got all these different devices and all these different platforms, different screen resolutions, screen sizes. But you know what? This is just the beginning. You know, we're just a couple years into this, and there's been this explosion of glowing rectangles, you know, that we have to sort of send our content to, and it's just going to get crazier, at least in the short term. So it's like being able to sort of think about how do you get your content out to all these different devices. It takes some smart thinking. That means we're thinking beyond just spraying our content to desktops.
Yeah, 5 years from now, there's going to be conferences just on designing for the steering wheel.
Right? I mean, seriously, you know? And it's and all these different use cases, too. I mean, you know, Nintendo's just come out with their successor to the Wii for the gaming system that has a touch screen in between your thumb controls. You know, it's the forms of these are changing fast.
We're screwed.
Well, you know, I mean, it's easy to feel that way, right? I mean, this is super exciting as a consumer, but man, our job is getting really hard. I mean, the thing is, though, it's not going to change, and so we have to sort of embrace it and rock it.
And maybe we've started to embrace specializing, right? When I first started doing web design, we didn't even call it web design. I mean, it was just, or it was called web design, but it was all programming and, you know, everything. You just made websites. I made websites. And and then we got to a certain point, and it was relatively late. I feel like it was like 2004 or 2005 was the first time I brought in like a CSS expert. And then realized, like, oh, we should have someone just sort of focusing on the actual, like, front-end stuff. And then I'll focus on, you know, the back-end stuff for this project, or I'll focus on the front-end start. And realizing, like, there were actually separate disciplines. And so, yeah, although it might seem overwhelming at first, I think if you start thinking of it more holistically, as like, yeah, okay, this is something, maybe you're a back-end person, but you might work on a project with a front-end person. You might work on a project with a mobile developer. And you're going to need to be able to sort of, manipulate the data, you know, in the same way that you think, okay, what does the designer need in order to make the site pretty, what does the mobile person need in order to create a compelling mobile experience?
Well, you know, I think that's definitely a part of it, you know, is like having people who are thoughtful about what the experience should be on each of these platforms. But I also think that there's that we kind of have to step back, and, you know, we've kind of been building websites the wrong way, it turns out, for the last, 15 years, you know, because we've been like, oh, the web is in a browser on the desktop, and, you know, and now we have this convention of whatever, oh, it's 960 pixels wide is sort of the, you know, kind of what you've got for real estate. And it turns out that sort of, now we talk about, oh, we need a mobile version. We need these versions of the website. When in fact, you know, the whole original premise of the web, right, was you'd build it once and it can be displayed on any platform. That it was sort of automatically this all-embracing thing. And so we sort of need to sort of step back, I think, and say, okay, wait a second, reset. The web is just this sort of neutral, you know, sort of content experience that we put out there that should be accessible on any device. And so there's sort of a need to kind of step back and rethink a little bit of what the web is. It's not a desktop medium for which we need to create different versions, and we need to start thinking about how do we design the web to be sort of device neutral, because that was its original premise.
Yeah. I've been doing a talk for a while there. So there was the Wired magazine had, was it the End of the Web or the Web is Dead or something? Web is Dead was the cover.
Right.
And I was thinking about it. It's like, that's not really what it is. And I started doing a talk called The Ascension of the Web, where I think the web is starting to not resemble the web. It's starting to move beyond, when you can start to display web-based data, one of the slides in my talk was the, I'm trying to remember the name of the company. They made a lamp, a light, basically, that changed colors based on the weather or based on stock stock prices and stuff.
Yeah.
And it would just change colors. That's all it did. It was like the idea was you walk by it on your way out the door and it's red, and so you grab a coat. Or it's
either
blue.
That or my stocks have crashed.
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember.
Either way, it's raining.
Exactly. Either way, you're going to want to grab a coat. And is that the web? Well, it's taking data that is also displayed on the web. Oftentimes, the web is the canonical location. One of the things with the Web is Dead article in Wired was they were saying, well, something, they had some statistics, 60% of the traffic on the internet right now is Netflix, and people are watching Netflix on their set-top boxes. So that's not the web. However, you can't sign up for Netflix on the set-top box. you have to go to the web. The web is the canonical location for Netflix.
Well, this is one of the things that I thought was, as we talk, it was just a couple days ago now that Steve Jobs did his keynote introducing iCloud. And that was super exciting to me. And we'll see if the thing actually works. Apple doesn't have the best sort of cloud track record. But, if it does, but in any case, the vision is very exciting, which is that, it's not about the desktop anymore. It's like you just have all these different devices, and the idea is sort of making it so that you can treat your phone or your tablet or whatever you've got. I mean, and in the future, right, set-top box, like all these different things are sort of on equal footing with the computer. And so the news for Apple was that they're finally sort of making it so you don't have to plug this stuff into a PC anymore. This stuff lives in the cloud, and sort of the cloud has the true version of the data. So it's all these different devices and local clients, sort of talking to the web to get the latest and greatest. I mean, I'm sort of using web and cloud interchangeably.
Well, and here it used to be Apple had this concept of the digital hub, and the digital hub was your iMac, right? That was the idea.
Right. It's got
USB, you plug everything into the USB hub, and the machine, your desktop machine, is the center of your digital hub. They've moved that. They've moved the center of the digital hub onto the web. And there's no reason that we who build websites can't start to take that same philosophy of, like, what you're creating when you're creating a website is the center of the data for this thing. If you're creating a web, let's just make up a website, a community website about dogs. Do you want to create a mobile app? Even just starting to think in terms of the semantic web, and even like web standards, kind of like when you create your page design or implement your page design, do it in a flexible way, because this is the data that's going to get represented in various places around the web, including places we haven't considered yet. We're basically one iteration of technology from, in fact, we already have, cars that will read you your email. We're really one iteration from the cars that read the web to you.
Well, and we're sort of talking about this sort of that we have like all these clients now. And again, stuff we haven't even, Jared's steering wheel, it's like we have all this stuff that we don't even know what it's going to be for. And so while we're sort of, we came into the web era with a lot of our content locked into legacy systems, right? And so we worked really hard to create, content management systems like Drupal, which is clearly sort of at the forefront of this thing at this point. But now we're also in a place where a lot of our content is sort of locked up into HTML and particularly sort of desktop HTML formats. That, I think one of our challenges going forward is how do we store and format our data so that we can send it out in ways that are maybe not even specifically you know, web specific, you know, being able to have neutral JSON feeds or whatever format makes sense so that the steering wheel can understand it, you know, so our talking car knows what to do with it. So, you know, mobile and touch is sort of the latest iteration, but there's all these different new ways to interact with data coming up. And we sort of have to think about the web as maybe even not being just screens.
You've been doing some talking about this idea of the myth of mobile context and how there's been this myth around that the mobile is this ultra limited experience of the full thing. Can you give examples or explain a little bit more about the idea of mobile potentially even doing more than the desktop?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, so like you said, you know, I think that a lot of us sort of went into this thing thinking, oh, these small screens, people are carrying these things on the go, let's streamline the experience to deliver sort of desktop light, because that's what people want and expect from mobile, and frankly, that's all we can kind of fit into this tiny screen. And I think that we have been sort of wrong about that, you know, that initial notion that a mobile version sort of necessarily should do less than the desktop is, I think, just wrong. You know, there's this idea, you know, as you said, I've been sort of talking about the myth of mobile context, as have several other people in the last few months. And there's this idea that, you know, mobile is for people who are in a rush, on the go, low attention. But the thing is that mobile isn't just on the go. You know, mobile is on the couch, you know, where I've got like an hour and a half of downtime and I'm like dinking around on my phone.
Right.
Mobile's in the kitchen. Mobile is everywhere. And so it's like, so our challenge is, wow, designing for everywhere. You can't just make assumptions that people want to do less just because they're on a small screen. All that we really know for sure is there's a small screen. And so just like how, you know, just because a paperback book has smaller pages, that doesn't mean that we should go removing entire chapters from it, right? It's all, you know, right. It's a small format. Now, you can make some guesses about how and where people are going to read this small format book. You know, you can make sort of inexpensive sort of pages to bring down the price and make it good for the beach and all that stuff. But you can't confuse context with intent. You know, that's sort of the big thing. Every time you are like, oh, well, nobody's going to want to do this on a mobile device, every time you say that, you are wrong. You know, it's definitely true that the format of the device changes the way we use it and lends itself to different things. You know, I mean, there's that popular thing that when the iPad first came out that people dismissed it and said, oh, just giant iPod Touch. But, you know, it's similar to an iPod Touch, right? But, you know, an iPad is like an iPod Touch in the same way that a swimming pool is like a bathtub. You know? Same characteristics, but it enables whole different sort of use cases. So sure, context does influence intent and how you want to use the things. But it also, you know, you can't sort of out of hand say that nobody wants this stuff. So an example, you asked for an example. So the Alibris is a bookseller, and they recently rolled out a mobile version of their website, which is not necessarily the whole full-featured thing. And among other things, they stripped out the rare books section, which Alibris sells, you know, used books and stuff like right. this. And they stripped out the rare books section on the assumption that it's like, well, if somebody wants to spend a few hundred bucks on a rare book, you know, they're going to want to do some searching. They're not going to want to deal with that with mobile. They're not going to want to make the commitment on price. But, you know, that's just wrong. I mean, eBay, for example, sells several Ferraris every month through their mobile app. People are willing to like make serious commitments.
Well, you know? I think you just want to, you know, there's a certain class of people that want to be sitting in a restaurant and go like, oh, maybe I'll just buy a Ferrari right now.
No, well,
impress your friends.
You and I were doing that just the other day, I think.
Well, yeah. Right. I really wanted to impress you. I got you on the podcast, so.
Yeah, that's right.
Aha.
Yeah, I love that, I'm here for your Ferrari.
I'll see you in a big O.
And I've got that, right. And I've got that damn Ferrari showing up in a couple days.
Right, right. And, that, and Jared really regrets his private jet that he just purchased. Yeah. No, but the point is that, you know, sure, you're not going to want to make these giant purchases every time. But don't sort of arbitrarily cut me off from content and features just because I'm on a small screen. We've all had this experience, I think, where we're on our phone and we're bumped over to a mobile website. And, you know, they've helpfully removed exactly the content or feature that we're looking for. You know, and we're like, swipe, 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 where's that link to the full desktop web? And now we're plowing through the big, heavy desktop site on our phones, having lost all of that design thinking that went into what will make this a good mobile experience.
Well, I think it's both scary and liberating at the same time. Because it's scary because it's like, how are we going to fit all of that information on this little device? And it's liberating in that, like, oh, now we don't need to decide which information to cut, which to remove.
I would modify that a little bit, because I think we do have some cutting to do. I mean, you know, sort of my friend Luke Rubluski has been pitching and I think really convincingly this concept of mobile first, of if you're starting a new design, especially, mm-hmm. A new site, start with mobile. And say, we do deal with constraints of space, and often we deal with constraints of attention, not always. So what is the most important stuff that we do? What are people really coming to our website for? And sort of using that sort of mobile experience as a kind of thought exercise, as a filter to say, what do we have to do? So I do think that you should cut a lot of stuff for your mobile website, but not because it's mobile. I think that there's a lot of crap on websites that shouldn't have been there on the desktop. You know, how can we improve our experiences? I mean, because in some cases where people have done it right, the mobile website is easier to use than the desktop website. You know, there's a better experience there. Jared, you asked about this. It's sort of like maybe we should be doing more. The thing is, we come into this idea where the mobile, we have this idea we should probably be doing less on the mobile web. Except the thing is that these devices can do more than the desktop. Yeah. They have a camera. They have audio. They have touch. Yeah. They have GPS. They have all this stuff. They have, they've got a gyroscope, for Christ's sake, on the iOS, on the iPhone.
Yeah, accelerometers.
What can you do with this? Sometimes there are going to be some features that are not just mobile first, but mobile only. And so there's a sort of notion of how do you think about building this stuff? And it's really one of not necessarily starting with the desktop and then creating some mobile version, but really the reverse, starting with a very neutral, simple, flexible grid design that will look great even on older sort of pre-iPhone phones, very sort of simple, flexible design that will work on desktop and all this other stuff. And then you use sort of media queries on CSS to sort of do some design thinking at specific screen sizes. And then you do some JavaScript browser sniffing to say, does this thing have GPS? Does this thing have touch? And bring in JavaScript libraries there. So you have this sort of layered approach of progressive enhancement, based on what the device is, but using that sort of same core of kind of, unimpressive HTML, simple CSS that's sort of like a bare bones website, just your content. And then, sort of start layering on design thinking and JavaScript functionality. So just this week, Ethan Marcotte's excellent new book, Responsive Web Design, came out. And it describes sort of exactly how to do this. It's a short read, around 100 pages. Great way to kind of get grounded in how do you start designing your website for kind of any device, even these devices that we don't yet know about or understand. And Ethan is involved, along with many other smart people, in the launch, not the relaunch, but the actual first launch of the Boston Globe website this summer. And I'm really excited to see it because they've used exactly this approach. Speaking of content management, this vast amount of content that they want to make, accessible on all devices, and that they've sort of applied these principles. So it's going to be a real sort of proof of concept, beyond that, but a real sort of proof of the idea that you can have a giant sprawling site that works great on Kindle and old, feature phones and the latest cutting edge devices, and even looking into the future. So I highly recommend that for anybody who's sort of interested in thinking about how do we get our content into all screen sizes. Responsive Web Design, Ethan Marcotte.
It's a great book. I've been really enjoying the irony of the fact that I'm reading it on my iPad. So,
yep.
It's really fun, actually. he starts the book talking to you about how, I don't even know how you're going to be reading this book.
It's great. I mean, it's great. Yeah, and his book, you know, on certain ebook versions has videos and screencasts. You know, it's a new world of publishing, that's for sure.
I do think it's interesting for designers like myself who have spent a lot of time, like, sort of learning the discipline of engineering and designing and thinking through what a website's going to be with the desktop browser in mind, that you don't sort of approach, you don't work with a client and say, okay, what does your company do? And you go through those kinds of processes to, you know, your whole design process. You don't tend to, like, look at those things and think, what a website is going to be able to do is like what you can do with an accelerometer and a locative, you know, information kind of a thing. There's like all these things that are possible in mobile that you don't even really think about in a lot of sort of planning processes for websites. So I've been kind of fascinated with ever since you tweeted like a couple of weeks ago, like maybe your website, your mobile version should do more. And I was like, huh.
Right. I mean, because, you know, especially in terms of sort of form inputs, you know, I mean, you see this a lot. Now, this is a difficult thing to do on the web because many of the browsers don't yet have access to the camera. But you see this in native apps a lot, right, is sort of for Amazon, for example. You know, you can look something up by scanning a barcode, which is much easier than typing in the title or the ISBN number or something like that. And similar, you know, audio. You know, it's like, what are all the different things that we can do to sort of speed input using these sensors? You know, because the great thing about the phone, you know, and we've been talking about personal computing since the days of disco, but, you know, this is really sort of the first true, you know, personal computer, not just because it's always with you, but because it knows so much about you. It knows what's around you and what's literally, because of the camera or the audio, what's right in front of you. You know, how do you use that to sort of help people get better context or speed inputs? And, you know, I think, you know, there's sort of a thing, you know, I said right now, it's, oh, well, the browser doesn't have access to the camera. That will come. You know, I'm confident of it. Jeff, you mentioned phone gap earlier, and for people who don't know what phone gap is, it's basically this kick-ass mobile browser that should have been the browser that's installed on your phone. But it's basically instead is sort of this Chrome-less browser that has no controls on it. That this is what you use when we were talking about hybrid apps. You write your web app and you pull and that PhoneGap comes essentially as the source code for this kick-ass browser. And so as I mentioned, the way that it works is you put in all your files for the web app into this thing, and then you know you compile it like you would a normal app, and it's an app, but it just happens to have your web app cooked into it. But the special magic, what makes it a kick-ass browser that should be the browser that all of these phones actually use, you know, built in, is that they've added all these JavaScript hooks into the device, you know, so that you can get access to the camera, so that you can get access to contacts, for example. Mm-hmm. So imagine sort of the possibilities now. If you have sort of full native level access to the device and to the system libraries, only you're able to draw your interface with familiar HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Yeah. So this is coming. The way that the PhoneGap people talk about it is like, we're a bridge. You know, it's like we're trying to build out ahead of the platforms so that they can kind of see, they can follow us and close this gap. I mean, from what I understand, the browser teams and all these platforms are kind of the redheaded stepchild. You know, they're not getting as much resources or respect, probably isn't the right word, but, you know, that they are, you know, I think Android and iOS and all the other places, you know, they believe in the app environment. I mean, even Android, which is obviously sort of very web-based.
Well, there's a better business model around it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think that people are necessarily, I'm not sure that the platforms are necessarily hostile to the web and to web apps. I mean, it's obviously an important part of our future, but I just think that they are more bullish on apps.
Did you happen to see the Windows 8 preview? Basically, it's almost like the entire operating system is going to function as a browser.
Yeah.
Apps can be built in HTML5, and it's an interesting concept. Just the whole idea of the browser being the full screen is a, you know, what sort of PhoneGap was accomplishing, and it's interesting to see, even though it's Microsoft, to see a you know, somebody actually trying out that direction with the entire operating system.
Yeah, well, and it's also like WebOS, you know, Palms and now yep. HP's WebOS, similar. I mean, I'm a little concerned about it just because, well, I think it's a great sort of way, especially if you don't have the full resources to build sort of full native apps. You know, the truth is that, you know, these web technologies are, you know, depending on what you want to do, can feel sluggish, you know, especially on mobile devices. You know, all this will improve as sort of the browsers improve, the underlying browser in this case, and the processor speed gets better. But, you know, it's sort of the truth is, you know, look, JavaScript is an interpreted language, and, you know, it's not as fast, as you know, sort of proper compiled languages. And so, you know, so I guess I love the option of being able to build, you know, sophisticated mobile apps, build their interfaces with familiar web technologies. But I also sort of don't want to lose the opportunity of like, wow, you can also build some serious kick-ass with compiled apps. I mean, you know, it's just like, you know, there are, I know, sort of people who are very ideological about this and are like, you know, the web will beat everything. But, you know, it's like, I don't want to experience all of my applications through a browser. Right. You know, like I love my desktop apps on my desktop. You know, and it's the right tool for the right job. And I guess I don't necessarily want to see one thing tilt all the other way. I mean, it's kind of a boring answer. But when people say, "Well, should this be mobile web or should this be native app?" You know, my answer is kind of, well, depends. It's kind of boring.
It really does depend. I mean, there's all these funny sort of oblique advantages to doing a full app. One of those is marketing.
Yep.
What wonderful marketing to have this icon on one of the pages of your apps. You know, there it is, reminding you, hey, here's this thing. Why don't you launch Twitter and go to Twitter? And you sort of browse through your apps in a way that nobody browses through bookmarks anymore.
Well, and there's on top of that, there's also just a real sort of cultural bias toward apps. Now, this is all very new, and we've only had sort of real mainstream app stores for the last, 3 years now, with the launch of the of Apple's App Store. But you know, it's the marketing, the operating systems, you know, the software all sort of says, you know what, you need an app for this, and for that you need an app store. And so while I think that there is and this might change, but for now I think I see this all the time in user interviews, is that for people there's a split between doing and reference. If someone wants to look something up or do something sort of one-off, they turn to the mobile web. But if they are thinking about doing something through a tool or playing a game or some recurring task, their thought immediately goes to apps. I mean, the problem is, for both, the discoverability is pretty crummy. You know, there's, I think, on the Apple App Store, there's now 425,000 apps. And there's this sort of gut reaction of like, oh, how am I possibly going to find the thing that I want? Or if I'm making an app, how can I possibly be discovered, right, among this sea of 425,000. But, you know, friends, I have to say, this is Alta Vista thinking. You know, we are in the Alta Vista days of app search, you know, where, remember, we had like a few hundred thousand pages, and it's like, oh, Alta Vista, you know, I can't find what I want. And then, you know, now Google solved that problem. We have billions of pages, and what you want typically turns up on the first 10 results. Yeah. So I'm confident that this will resolve itself. But for now, it turns out that basically over 50% of iPhone users, at least, say that they just rely on word of mouth. And then they download from the App Store.
You hear that, folks? Josh is saying the app search engine is the next Google.
Yeah, that's it. Get after it.
Start writing it, folks. You could be the future Larry Page. Go!
Ever since they made the sort of the web version of iTunes, like, all of a sudden that's the case. Like, I actually can search for apps, like iPhone apps in Google, you know, and it pulls up the iTunes URL for me and lets me even now preview and see what the app is and stuff. So that, for a long time, actually, that was like something that bothered me, and I thought, boy, this is weird that there's like nobody else can help improve this whole search experience for apps, but it's not really the case anymore.
Yeah, no, that definitely helps. I mean, there's a downside. I guess, you know, for for both better and worse, the developers have very little control over the content of those pages or the format of those pages, right? So they can sort of put in their description and their keywords and then sort of hope for the best. On the other hand, you know, that what it means is that you can't do sort of SEO, but it also means you can't do sort of black hat SEO either. So it's I guess maybe it comes out even either way.
Yeah.
So okay, I think we've made a good case that people should start thinking about mobile. but where should they start? I guess we're seeing more and more examples, and as more apps get out there, more ways of doing things, more things like Flipboard come out, right? And you think, oh, I've never seen this kind of a thing before. But as you start using it, you're like, okay, I get this. I understand what's happening here. We start to build a palette of experience, of interface, stuff that we've seen, and it all starts to seem a little bit more doable. We started building an app. We're building an app for Drupalize Me, which is our video training, Drupal video training website. And seemed like it would be really great to have an app for it. So we started building it. And initially, we thought, okay, it's going to be very simple. You're going to bring it up. It's just going to be just the videos in your queue and you can click and watch them and that's it. If you want to even like searching or, you know, basically you go back to the website and you add things to your queue. And then, As Jared started doing the wireframing for it, you know, kind of grew a little bit and grew a little bit more. And now it's, as it's coming together, it's got, I mean, the actual functionality of the website is very simple, and that's very intentional. We didn't want it to be a complicated website. We wanted it to be easy to find videos and watch the videos. That's the focus. But we're getting pretty much all of the functionality of the website into the app now. And honestly, awesome. when we first started thinking about it, I didn't think we could do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so I think that we have as an industry, we have an appropriate respect and desire to make sort of simple experiences, right? And and sometimes we can kind of go too far with that on mobile, that we oversimplify. And we have to sort of remember that complexity is awesome. You know, complexity is like what gives our life texture, and it's what we as designers and developers need to be able to use and put to work in order to help people take on, you know, complex tasks.
Yeah.
And so our job is not to remove complexity. It's to make complexity uncomplicated. And those are two different things, right?
Yes.
So it's hard. It's hard work to make complexity manageable, especially on a small screen, but it is worth the work because people want that. They don't want dumbed down apps. They want complex but uncomplicated apps. And that's hard. That is, you know, effortless takes a lot of work. As it sounds like, you know, you found, but maybe it's like the more that you sort of chip away at it and have faith in it, which it seems like, Jeff, you guys did with this app, you know, you find that it is
it's not out yet. We'll leave it to the people.
That's right.
I'm not making any promises, but yeah, no, it's I mean, it's a joy to use. When you can get all of that stuff in there, so you're not really maiming the experience. It's a really you're gaining a lot of the actually really nice interactions, the swiping and touching, and you know, it's a nice way to interact with a device, and you know, if you're kind of getting everything along with that, it's good.
Yeah, well, and I should, that's great that you sort of brought up those interactions. Is you know, the you know, I mentioned sort of doing some, you know, for websites, sort of this whole notion of progressive enhancement and doing some feature sniffing through JavaScript to say, oh, does this device have touch? And sort of adding in some things to be able to manipulate even your mobile website with sort of swipe events. You know, you see, it's hard. You know, designing sort of complex gestures, even in native apps, is a challenge. And with JavaScript, the tools make it really, you kind of have to do this thing from scratch. That said, swipes are not too difficult to do. And you see, for example, on the iPad version of Flickr, you can swipe through slideshows. Or and on the New York Times, I've got a front page carousel that you can swipe through, and you can swipe left and right through articles on the New York Times. So these are not necessarily huge things, but as you said, they're nice interactions that, you know, these devices are creating expectations for how we interact with these websites, right? And yet the web is not yet great at supporting those interactions and takes a little doing, but I think that it's worth it because it creates a great experience. One other thing, though, it sort of reminds me of when you're sort of saying it's like, you know, it's been a good experience sort of getting everything in there. Sort of one little story that's, I think, an illustration for what I'm talking about, why mobile needs to be able to be at least on par with the desktop, is the original Facebook app, you know, the native iPhone app that came out the very day that the App Store opened. And Joe Hewitt was the one-man show who built that app and built the first three versions of the Facebook app. And, you know, he tells the story. It's like, you know, my assumption, and it was a convenient assumption because he only had a little bit of time to build the thing, was that he was going to build a companion app. You know, that this is sort of what you... And nobody really knew what to expect of third-party apps at this point, right? So his assumption was, I'm going to build a companion app to the website so you can kind of check in on Facebook when you're away from your desk. And so it was pretty limited functionality. And it turned out he was wrong, you know? Like, immediately, millions of people told him how much his work sucked, which is always a pleasure. And it turns out, you know, that they were sort of like, well, look, you know, we can't comment on somebody else's post. We can't look at somebody else's photos. Without sort of a base level of functionality, this isn't Facebook. You know, this actually isn't the app. And so they found that sort of that stripped down version was actually kind of patronizing and condescending. And so there's a thing of sort of, you know, if you oversimplify, as I said, you just wind up with something that's dumbed down that people, you know, don't want or don't find useful or isn't the app that they expect.
Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get back to I sort of glossed over this question. Where should people start with this? And I guess another question, we just kind of launched right into the interview, but like, how did you get started in all of this, Josh?
Yeah, well, so I have a dirty confession to make, which is that for most of my career, I had no interest in mobile. I didn't even have a phone. I was very hostile to the phone. You know, it's sort of like the
nothing worse than a convert.
You know, it's like, right, it's you know, the last thing that I wanted was somebody like calling and springing themselves on me, you know, in the middle of something else. So I liked being able to make calls, but I didn't really like receiving them.
Yeah, I can relate.
You know, right. I think a lot of us have very complicated relationships with the phone. And probably for a lot of us, this new sort of generation of mobile devices, the phone is sort of like the least interesting app on the screen, right? But no, so basically when the iPhone came out, I, you know, thought, man, this is the thing, this is awesome. This is sort of my first time in my adult life when my childhood vision of the future kind of came to pass. You know, it's like, so I got very excited about the possibilities of the iPhone. Before then, I'd been doing web design and development, and in the early 90s had even sort of tinkered with my own content management system, as I think many of us did.
We've all been there.
Yeah, right. And so, but sort of having a, you know, sort of supporting several thousand designers and sort of building all the various widgets for that, I think gave me, and I think that a lot of your listeners here have a similar experience, a real sort of facility with recognizing and using design patterns. And so as I really sort of dug into the iPhone in particular, you know, sort of started to really do a lot of thinking and you know, reviewed thousands of apps to kind of identify, you know, what is it that makes a great app, not just from a design point of view, but also from an information architecture, features point of view, you know, what is it that draws us to great apps. And that's my book, Tapworthy, came out of that to sort of say, look, this is how to, you know, how to think iPhone, essentially, or more broadly, how to think mobile. And so it really identifies, you know, kind of the ways to think about both what your app should do and why, as well as some of this sort of nitty-gritty iPhone-specific design patterns. But what's been really interesting is that a lot of developers from other platforms, Android and Windows Phone, have told me is that they have found it really useful for their own work. So while it uses sort of iPhone as a focus, my book Tapworthy, I think, is something that's useful for kind of anybody broadly who's interested in the design of apps and even mobile websites. But, you know, where to start? Well, gosh, I think that's not a bad place to start.
Buy Josh's right. book.
Yes, it actually is fantastic and very helpful if you're designing. Very practical book. So,
thanks so much, Jared. It means a lot. It's and I think also in terms of thinking about for the web, you know, I think that, as I mentioned, you know, Ethan Marcotte's responsive web design just out this week is a terrific place to sort of start thinking about. Right, okay, well, how do I think about cramming all this content into small screens? How do I present this on this range of devices that I may not even know about yet? And sort of future-proofing your website. You know, way back, God, it's been 10 years now, you know, since Jeffrey Zeldman really started to lead the standards push, you know, to be sort of like, you know, we need to use standards so it's accessible on all devices. And now this is sort of the next generation of that, of you know, I think that responsive web design is not the complete solution, but an important sort of piece in your toolkit to sort of move forward into a multi-device world. And I think that this is the standards sort of discussion of 10 years ago, but now for this sort of new era, this new era that Steve Jobs was describing of sort of a bunch of different devices. That's not, you know, where the desktop is no longer the hub.
Right.
Yeah, and I think, you know, building the mobile version of your site is probably a good place for people to get started, because there's really no new technology that you need to learn above and beyond kind of what you've already done to build the desktop version of your site. It's just different CSS stuff maybe that you hadn't looked into, and you might want to look into something like jQuery Mobile to use for your mobile site. I mean, we could talk more specifically about ways to do that in Drupal. You know, Drupal has a really wonderful aspect that is kind of this sort of legacy functionality. Drupal features the ability to have and even enable multiple themes on your site. And you could conceivably let users choose which theme they wanted, which I refer to as a legacy thing, because it's this real, like, old-fashioned hacker kind of thing. Do you choose whether you want a blue background on your site or a green background?
Let the users design it.
Yeah, let the users design it, which, for, you know, then once you start working with designers, they're like, why would you do that? We spent a whole lot of money designing and branding, you know, this site. But now, this ability, not necessarily for the users to switch, but to let maybe a module which does some mobile detection, maybe redirect them to m.example.com and use a mobile theme on that site would allow you to sort of you know, fundamentally change the HTML of the site and maybe slim it down for lower bandwidth and maybe use something like jQuery Mobile to start adding some more rich interface interactions something like that. And of course there's also the more adaptive method, which is just to actually start adding CSS to your main site to do adaptive layout, adaptive design stuff there.
And I would say that in most cases, that second approach is going to be the one that we should be aiming for in the future.
Yeah.
You know, and that I understand that that might be sort of a hard thing to sort of go to right now, because it sort of really means, like, wow, starting at the beginning, building your site from this very sort of basic kind of HTML and sort of gradually adding more and more features. And it's you know, I don't want to present that as being like this simple thing to do. I think it takes a lot of thought and sort of like where you're going to put in what Ethan calls sort of the breakpoints of sort of common device width. So this is for the 10-inch, this is for a 10-inch tablet, this is for 7-inch, this is for a Droid size phone, etc. So it's hard work. And so I think in a lot of cases, yeah, a good stopgap and probably an easier one for a lot of people, rather than building a website that works for all, is, you know, sort of in the meantime, building a themed sort of mobile specific version. Of course, the thing is that mobile, you know, has become this shorthand for anything that's not desktop. And in a way, it sort of is hurting us a little bit, you know, because it's like, well, which mobile are you talking about? You know, we've got all these different, you know,
well, we've been
all
doing
different sizes.
And, we've been doing a lot of thinking about IPTV, which is using all the mobile platforms. Google TV is using Android. Apple TV, at least under the hood, is using iOS. And there are these rumblings that maybe one day they'll let us install apps. However, and I'm sure that one of the reasons that they're not allowing us to install apps yet is because the television interface is going to be different. You know, you can't walk up to the TV and swipe, and you don't want to. You don't want to because you'd smear it. And you know, I already have enough trouble with a 7-year-old in the house smearing things on the TV. Right. I don't need to add.
Or who knows? You know, it's like you see this Wii remote that's got a touchscreen in it. You know, that you can like play the game on it or use it as a controller. It's right. I mean, we're still evolving interfaces there. But no, it's a great point. Is TV. Is that one of the mobile platforms we're talking about? I think in a lot of cases, yeah. I mean, I think mobile has to be shorthand for not a desktop.
Well, even in talking about, you know, this thread at Do It With Drupal, you know, we're like, well, we want to talk about mobile and IPTV and other stuff, and there's no word for all that sort of, it's like non-desktop web technology,
traditional computing environment.
So we're still working it out. Some again
beyond the desktop browser, essentially.
Yeah, it's pretty good. BTDB. It's got a ring
Netflix,
to it, Jared. I think you've got it.
I don't know if anybody else noticed, but I actually just noticed yesterday. I don't know when they rolled it out, but Netflix is starting to roll out their new interface on the desktop browser, which is essentially influenced by the work they did developing the UI for the TV originally for the PS3 interface that got pulled into the Roku. It got pulled into their app for other, you know, television set-top devices, which they've got a ridiculous number of set-top box devices that all run a different code-based version of their app that actually
functions. Over 400 devices, I think.
Wow. Yeah, it's insane. Like, the idea of making that many different instances of an app just scares me. But
well, and you know, and for the most part, you know, where they can, basically WebKit is their platform.
Right.
You know, so they're doing it as much as possible using HTML5 because, you know, I think that you feel it sometimes, right? And their apps, sort of a little kludgy. You can tell that there's like some web stuff happening there, and it doesn't have the, especially, you know, on thinking about now on sort of phones and tablets.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily have that smooth slickness of a native app. But hey, you know what? At least, I mean, they've got it on 400 devices. So there's sort of, there's always sort of these competing concerns of great user experience and sort of business resources. And, you know, in truth, if you want the best user experience, it's going to be through all native apps. I mean, that's just, I think, going to be the best user experience. But then again, one of the best experiences is, can you use the thing at all? You know, so it's like, if this is what lets them get onto all devices, then awesome. But one thing you bring up that's really exciting is sort of this flow of inspiration that's happening among devices in terms of interface design. Like, wow, they took the PlayStation interface and are now like applying it to the desktop. You know, this, and you see
that's
it, like, for example.
At, yeah.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
That was what I was excited about. Yeah, it's like, wow.
Well, it's this iterative process.
You know, right, we're learning about sort of, I think that sort of this new sort of generation of interfaces and sort of possibilities of getting to things with these devices has sort of injected some real excitement and new ideas back into the desktop. You know, you see it certainly with Apple's new operating system, the Lion operating system, which is coming out, I guess, next month. You know, a lot of influence from particularly iPad apps. You know, it's sort of the new mail app for the Mac is going to look a lot like the iPad mail app.
Yeah, it used to be that when you're on your notebook or your laptop, depending on what you call it, you would be frustrated because you would miss your mouse and you didn't want to use this big trackpad thing. You know, like it's like, I wish I had my mouse now. Where now it's like people are going out and buying the new big trackpad thing for the Mac, you know, for their iMac, because it's like there's all these things you can do with that that you just can't do with a mouse. Like,
yeah,
touch just...
All the swipes, and I mean, right, Jeff, you mentioned that too. It's sort of like, wow, this is a nice way to interact with information. In fact, I have this whole spiel about how kind of buttons are a hack. And that, and you know, and I mean that, you know, even in the offline world, you know, a light switch over here to turn on a light bulb over there is not intuitive. Like, making that connection is you know, this is a workaround. I mean, it's a necessary workaround and a brilliant one, because the last thing you want to do is walk into a dark room with a ladder and try to find that. Right? So a necessary workaround, a necessary hack. Right. But it's not working on the primary object. You know, it's sort of, so in terms of touch design, you know, there is this real sort of sense of I don't know, intimacy in a way of working with information directly. But sort of don't confuse touching a button with that kind of intimacy, because you're still not sort of touching the content, the data. And one of the things that's for good reason, you know, we've developed this sort of whole set of metaphors on the desktop of buttons and tabs and menus. But I think that, you know, but again, those are sort of hacks and workarounds. And sort of as we sort of go into this world of designing for touch, I think that one thing that we have to think about is, it's like, right, this is, do I need this hack anymore? Or can I actually swipe and work directly with the content? You know, in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan famously said, you know, the medium is the message, right? But now I think that we might be in an era where the message is the medium, the content is the control, you know, the information is the interface. We can sort of scrub away a lot of this chrome. So what that means, you know, as we sort of think about designing for different devices and designing for this multi-device world, is that, you know, some of this may be more than just simple layout changes. You know, I mean, I think that's where we start when we have but I think that, again, layering on, detecting, is this a touch device? Well, if this is a touch device, then I'm going to drop in these libraries that, and maybe hide these buttons so that I'm actually going to now be controlling through swiping and tapping and pinching, which sounds kind of dirty when you get right down to it. But, you know, is you know, instead of having sort of more traditional Chrome, and especially on a small screen, that opens things up for more space for content and less for navigation and controls. But I agree with you, Jared. I think it's really exciting that we're starting to see this kind of inspiration coming from across devices. So the thing that I would encourage all designers is, you know, keep your eyes open. I mean, we've got more and more of these devices and new ways to interact with our information and our content. And, you know, sort of let some of those new devices inspire you and bring that stuff into your desktop designs as well as your mobile designs.
Yeah.
Yeah, and starting to unify everything a little bit more, just thinking holistically. We were talking about adaptive design, and I found that the site I was thinking of. So hicksdesign.co.uk is a wonderful inspiration. It's got some nice content, but the real thing to do with the site is open it up in your desktop web browser. Hicks Design, HICKS Design, DESIGN.co.uk, and then start resizing your browser. Narrow, more narrow. And when you get down very, very, very narrow, as narrow as you can get it, in fact, you might not even be able to get narrow enough depending on which desktop browser you're using, you get to their mobile version of the site. And each, you know, you kind of get to the iPad size, and it's just fascinating to watch the site redo itself. And this is, Josh, what you said Boston Globe's working on right now, right?
Right, exactly. And you know, and there are even things, if you think about it, I mean, this is done through media queries, which basically says, how wide is the device screen? You know, and then for that, here's like all these CSS rules for that. So you could have, essentially, you know, if you wanted to sort of, you could literally have a different style sheet for every single device that you can think of that you know the pixel dimensions for, although that's probably a little overkill. But what it does mean is that you can, you know, actually, you know, this is sort of in a way, sort of the tip of the iceberg of this is just sort of changing some of the layout things. But if you think about, you know, using media queries to detect, you know, what your orientation is, you could have a completely different display for landscape versus portrait.
Mm.
You know, which could just be a matter of having like a, you know, I don't know. Look at a lot of stocks apps, for example, on phones. You know, often they'll have sort of in portrait, sort of a text based view, but you turn it on landscape and you see a graph view. Well, that is super easy to do, right? It's just like you put this image in a div that you show in landscape. Versus, you know, your text-based HTML that you show in portrait, and it just will switch automatically just with a little media query. You know, so it's you can think about orientation and screen size to have, you know, very different displays, not just sort of layout changes. It's pretty powerful.
The future is cool, man.
Yeah, I love the future. I think we all love the future. I don't know. Just sort of one quick story. I suspect we're probably getting to the end here. But, you know, I mentioned that the iPhone was kind of my, sort of the first time in my adult life that my childhood vision of the future had kind of come to pass. And it's really literally true. When I was in elementary school in Minneapolis in the 70s, we had this at my public school had these great assemblies. You know, we had like a Secret Service agent. We had like a swami who could concentrate and push all of his blood into his right leg. You know?
At your school?
Of school. You know, yeah. Right.
Wow. This was our
assembly. And then there was this one guy, though. I remember, I guess it must have been 1977 because Star Wars had just come out. And there's this guy who made electronic music. And so I was six. And so I was little. So in my memory, you know, the stage was filled with these, like, giant, I don't know, like, mainframes and, you know, like, and there's this sort of one little wiry guy in a t-shirt running around, you know, making all these noises, making R2-D2 noises, which, as I said, Star Wars had just come out. So he had this room in the palm of his hand, you know, all these elementary school kids going nuts. So it was very impressive. And at the very end, he steps to the edge of the stage, and he pulls out his wallet, and he holds it up in his hand, and he says, you know, one day when you guys grow up, you will have a device this size in your pocket that will let you do all of what I've just done with all this fancy equipment and more. And it's like something that stuck with me, you know? And it's like, yeah. When the iPhone came out, it's like, oh my God, this is it, and I want to know.
Did you download the R2-D2 app?
Right, exactly. But who was this guy? No?
Who was this guy?
Who was it? Yeah, and now the iPhone and the Android devices are even becoming our wallet. So.
Yeah, right, exactly. You know, it's sort of all in one.
Ray Kurzweil's not from Minneapolis, is he?
Right. I mean, something like that. It's like, I wonder. It's like,
because he would be the guy to do that.
He's probably like, you know, some guy who's like drunk in the alley. Steve stole his ideas.
It's like, give me my wallet back. I want to make R2-D2 noises.
Don't we all? That's
yeah, best. Yeah. No, I mean, the iPhone's the tricorder, man. This is Star Trek. We're ready to. All we need is the beamer. What's the beamer called then?
Right. That's going to come. I mean, it's just the thing is that I think that AT&T is really skeptical about sort of opening up its network to the teleportation.
Teleporting, yeah. Yeah.
You know,
yeah. There's the bandwidth issue.
Signal in the middle of that one.
It's
know?
A lot. Yeah. It's bandwidth problems. That's why we need to net neutrality so that we can transport from, you know. The rising prices of gasoline and how much it costs for air travel and stuff like that wouldn't really just be easier to have a transporter.
I think it certainly would be convenient.
Well, on that note,
I'm looking forward to transporting down to do it with Drupal.
There you go. Yes. Well, Josh, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was really great to talk to you and get the Drupal community thinking yet more about mobile, and we'll see you in October, and who knows, maybe I'll even run into you in Providence if they'll let me over the border.
You're always welcome in Rhode Island, Jeff.
Thanks.
Thanks, you guys. This was a blast.
Thanks a lot.
All right. Take care, Josh.